Welcome to Context, a podcast about the history behind current events in the Middle East. I'm Becky Nyman. The history will be provided through audio recordings of my late father, Dr. David Nyman. My father was an expert in the history of the ancient Near East and specialized in the Jewish background to the New Testament and the relationship between the church and the Jews. My father was a rationalist. He based his theses on historical records, linguistics, and a deep understanding of the Bible, both Old and New Testaments, and their origins. Through this rich history that's been preserved in these recordings, I'm going to try to provide a different and deeper perspective on the issues facing the world today. Today's episode is called The Lord, the Land, the Law, where we explore elements that define the Jewish people. Father Felix F. Talbot was a colleague of my father's in the theology department at Boston College, a Catholic university outside of Boston. My father told me that Father Talbot liked to make up clever little devices to help his students remember things. The Lord, the Land, the Law was the mnemonic device Father Talbot used to help his students remember the three elements that he said define the Jewish people: the concept of one God, a connection to the land of Israel, and the law of the Bible. The Lord, the Land, the Law sounds like it could be part of the catechism. I'd never heard this definition in all my years of Jewish schooling. My father quoted it to me when we were engaged in some spirited discussion about Judaism in Israel around the kitchen table. Perhaps because this definition came from an outsider and a Jesuit priest, no less, I gave it extra weight and conceded whatever point I had been trying to make. The following audio clips explore the history and concepts behind these three elements. The first one is the Lord. The Jewish people are uncompromising when it comes to the idea that there's only one God with no half-God, half-man manifestations. This next audio clip examines how this simple concept contradicted all the existing cosmologies of its day.
The forces which are in nature are the creative forces. Since they are forces, they act. They have a will of their own. They're eternal. If you combine will and eternity, you've got a God. It's a simple definition. So these are the gods of the pagans. The gods of the pagans are not simply figments of imagination. They are descriptions of phenomena. Every phenomenon is described one form or another. Some are big, some are small. I'll tell you a very beautiful story from Greek mythology. There is a woman by the name of Demeter, called Ceres in Latin. Ceres, of course, is cereal. Demeter plants and she harvests and she provides food for all humanity. Now, she has a young daughter, pretty young girl, by the name of Persephone. While mother is working, she's playing. Well, that's okay. She dances, and she runs in the fields, and she throws flowers around. She's just a happy girl, very pretty and happy. Now there's a guy, and his name in Greek is Hades. In Latin, it's Pluto. Hades is king. He's king of a great big kingdom. But it's a dark kingdom, and it's somehow down below. And Hades is a bachelor, but he wants to get married. But no one wants him. As soon as he approaches someone, they run away. And as he is going around, he sees this gorgeous young Persephone, and he desires her. As soon as he gets close, her mother gets up and says, "Don't you dare come close." But one day, when she happens to be bowed down and tilling the ground, he gets into his high-powered chariot, and he just swings by between mother and daughter, grabs the girl, throws her into the back seat, and down he goes to his kingdom. And mother starts to cry and scream and sits down and mourns. And as she mourns, the crops die, and people begin to die of hunger. And the assembly of the gods come down and say, "Ceres, Demeter, get to work." She says, "No, as long as my daughter is gone, I don't work. I want my child back." They go down to Hades and they say, look, man, mother is not working. You better send her back. He said, what? I got this gorgeous girl and you want me to give her back? Oh, no. I took her. She's mine. They come back and say, look, we want to tell you something. If all the people died of hunger because mother ain't working, they're going to fill your place and you're not going to have a place to move. You better make a deal. Well, what do you suggest? Let her go home to mother 6 months. And we promise that we'll go back to you 6 months. You can live without her for 6 months. Then she'll come back. They go to mother and they say, okay, we'll get your daughter back for half a year. But then she'll have to go back to her husband. So she says, well, as long as she's here, I'm working. Now, Persephone comes back. Persephone throws flowers and dances. She says, oh, that's her thing. And mother works and plants and so on. Then Persephone, the time is up, and she has to go back. So mother says, okay, daughter, as long as you're gone, I'll just sit here and cry. And she goes back. Now, it's a pretty story. Let's translate the words. Persephone means spring. Spring is flowers. Spring is the blooming. Ceres or Demeter means Mother Earth and creator of cereal or food. Hades is the god of death. When spring comes, then the land flourishes. When the fall comes, crops begin to die and the cold sets in and spring goes down to hell to be with her husband. And so the cycle of the seasons is simply portrayed, simple story. It's a cycle of seasons, but you put it into dramatic form, and then you can put it on a stage, and you can set it to music, and it becomes pretty. This is what they did with their phenomena. They're all true stories, but they are dramatized and personified. The phenomena are personified, and they're dramatized. But basically, what does it say? The pagan cosmology says, the universe is the product of the conflict of the forces of the universe. When they finally reach an equilibrium, the world comes into being. And it's always an equilibrium which has a little bit of imbalance, because sometimes that nasty Boreas is going to say, well, I'm going to sneak in here and give them a shot of snow and cold when their back is turned, but then they gather together and they push him back. So you have the imbalances. We have a universe. Everything is okay, but then you have an earthquake, and then you have a storm, and then you have a cyclone, and then you have a tornado. And a lot of things are happening. We are under the control of these powerful forces, and they brought the universe into being, and we live in it. But remember, we are just really insignificant, and they are the great forces. And basically, they control the world, and they control us. There are other factors, of course, that enter into it, the whole story of the fates and so on. The universe of the pagans, therefore, is a universe which you could say is polypotential, many forces, or polytheistic, if you want to use that word, many gods, many phenomena which are eternal and which have their own will. So there are many gods. So it becomes polytheistic. And they're not polytheistic and they're not pagan because they're stupid. Pagan writings are the writings of very brilliant people. It's just their theory. They believe that there are many gods that control the universe, and this is what they believe. And they control in many ways, even controlling the individual at times under particular moments and conditions. You read the first chapter of Genesis, and you see what the writer has done. He throws the entire concept out, rejects it. To the Genesis cosmologist, there is one force only who creates all the other phenomena, and they all derive from him, from that one creative force. Call him or her, what's the difference? Point is, one phenomena, one power.
Next is the land. Whether or not you feel the connection with Israel and the Jewish people is legitimate, the fact remains that it exists, and it's been around for a very long time. The land of Israel and Jerusalem have been mentioned in prayers by Jews in their literature, art, and song for millennia. There is archaeological evidence, there is the Hebrew language, and our alphabet, all pointing to the land of Israel. So the question is, where did it all begin? It all began with Genesis chapter 15, and the next audio segment by Dr. David Nyman reviews those very significant passages of the Bible.
Now, chapter 15. Chapter 15 is very interesting in that it is the covenant between God and Abraham. Of course, it's rooted in the idea of what Abraham and his descendants thought of Abraham's entry into the land of Canaan. At the beginning of chapter 12, Abraham moves to the land of Canaan under the impulse of the divine advice. God says to him, leave your native land, your father's house, and go to the land I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. In chapter 15, God appears to Abraham, it says, in a vision, and says, fear not, I will be your shield, and your reward will be very great. Then Abraham says something very interesting. Abraham says, O Lord God, what can you give me when I walk childless and the man who is in control of my property is Damascus Eliezer, Eliezer Damascus, which means a man by the name of Eliezer from Damascus. Verse 3 is only a translation of verse 2. Verse 3, Abraham says, you have not given me a son, and the man who is the son of my household will inherit me. And then the word of the Lord came to him and said, this man will not inherit you, but only the one who will come out of your own loins, he will be your heir. And he took him outdoors, and God said, look at the heavens and count the stars, if you can count them. And he said, thus will be the number of your descendants. And Abraham believed in God, and this was righteousness for him. Now, this whole conversation is interesting because Abraham is talking about the legal position that he is in. We know from Babylonian law, it's written right into the Constitution, if a man has property and he has no appointed heir, you know who gets his property? The IRS. The government takes it. If a person dies without a will, without a designation, government comes in. Under Babylonian law, if a person did not have someone designated with a contract saying, you are my heir, then that was bad. Therefore, we find that every person of property under Babylonian law had a designated heir. It gets very interesting and complicated, but the point is they all do that. Now, Abraham is married to Sarah. He doesn't have an heir, but he appoints someone. He makes him his heir. Why? Because if I die, I have no children, I want my wife to be taken care of, so he appoints him with conditions. Conditions would be simple, such as long as my wife lives, she lives in the house, and you take care of her, and you can provide her with so much and so much money, as long as she lives, but you are my heir, which means after she dies, you inherit everything. So if a man appoints an adopted person or a stranger, he may feel, okay, everything is taken care of. On the other hand, he may also feel, you know, it's not quite what I want. I'd like to have a son of my own, as Abraham says. And by the way, this goes on in Babylonian contracts. We see this all the time. Childless couples adopt someone. He takes care of them, he runs the economy, he takes care of the farm, he takes care of the house. He inherits their property when they die. So he says, this man who is the one who runs my property, he is the one who takes care of everything. I have 318 shepherds, I have tens of thousands of cattle and sheep and all of that, and this man is not my son, and yet I gave him a contract, and that contract says, as long as he is in control, he is my heir. The only thing is, we know that Abraham did not give him what we call an irrevocable designation of inheritor. He gave him a designation as heir, which could be changed. And specifically, they will write into it, if I have a son of my own, he will become primary heir. In that case, you will become secondary heir. In other words, he couldn't disinherit the man whom he appointed, but he could reduce his status and say, in effect, look, if I don't have any children, you have everything after I die. But if I should have a child of my own, I'm going to make him primary heir and give him an irrevocable designation, in which case you will have to become number two heir and share the property. He will get two-thirds of the property, you will get one-third. But because that's the situation, the manager of the estate could say, well, as long as my master doesn't have a son of his own, I'm the potential heir. But if he has a son of his own, and he will make him primary heir, then I will only own one-third of the property. At which point, I will say to my master, give me my share in cash, I'll sign away my rights, and goodbye. I'm still young enough to go and become a manager of another estate. And many men did this. If they were dispossessed from the primary position, they could take another position, and they could, in effect, take their share in movable property. Movable property means cash, it would mean 1,000 sheep and 100 oxen and so on. Whatever my share is, I'll take it now, and I will have no claim on your property. It's important to understand, because later on, when we hear the servant of Abraham, it's not Eliezer. So obviously he departed. So that's the story at this point. He says, I only have a manager of my estate, and I've appointed him heir. And God says to him, don't worry, your own son will be your heir. Because here he says, Eliezer Damascus will be my heir. So he said to him, I am your Lord God who took you out of the Ur Kasdim, the Ur of the Chaldees, to give you this land and to inherit it. Abraham said, oh Lord, how will I know that I will inherit the land? And God says to him, now make a sacrifice. And the sacrifice is a three-year-old calf and three-year-old goat and a three-year-old ram and a dove and a young pigeon. And he took all of these and he cut the animals and he put them on the altar. And then a vulture came down and Abraham drove it away, whatever that means. And the sun was about to set and a deep sleep fell over Abraham and a great fearful darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abraham, you should know that your descendants are going to be strangers in a strange land, and they will be slaves, and they will persecute them for 400 years. But the nation that they will serve, I will judge. And after that, they will emerge with great wealth. And you will be gathered to your fathers in peace. I mean, you're going to die in peace. And you will be buried with a ripe old age. But the fourth generation will return here because the sin of the Amorite is not yet finished. And that is another problematic term. And I have a feeling that this refers to the fact that the empire that ruled here, and there's still a lot of them around, they're still going to remain in power until such time as your people take it over. And then the sun was setting, and there was a darkness, and all of a sudden a fiery furnace and a torch of fire which passed between the cut pieces of the flesh. And in that day, God sealed a covenant or cut a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I give this land from the Wadi of Egypt, the river of Egypt, not the Nile, but the dry riverbed which runs between Israel and Egypt, to the great river, which is the river of Euphrates, and the Keni, and the Knezi, and the Kadmoni, and the Chiti, and the Prizi, and the Rephaim, and the Amori, and the Canaani, and the Girgashi, and the Yebusi, and all of these nations will be absorbed by your descendants when your descendants become the inheritors of this land. Now, I'll tell you something interesting about this chapter, chapter 15. What's so important about it? Chapter 15 is important because this lays the foundation for the whole Israelite concept that God promised the land to the children of Abraham. This is it. Why should the people of Israel have a claim to the land of Israel? Because God promised the land to the children of Abraham. And it's chapter 15. Now I'll tell you something else which is interesting. When did the Vatican recognize Israel? About 10 years ago, the Pope in Rome said he would like to visit the synagogue in Rome. This was another break with eternal tradition. I mean, no Pope had ever gone to the synagogue. The Jews used to come to the Pope and ask him to, you know, reconfirm their rights. But the Pope said he would like to go to the synagogue, and he did. And it was a very interesting ceremony. So the Pope came to the great synagogue in Rome, and the chief rabbi of Rome, Rabbi Elio Tawaf, was there. And they had an interesting ceremony with the readings from the Torah, and the readings from the Torah in Hebrew and in Italian, and speeches and so on. Well, the portion they read from the Torah was chapter 15 of Genesis. So I was speaking to the secretary of the Catholic bishops of the United States, and I said, that's very interesting that they read the 15th chapter of Genesis. He said, look, when the Pope goes into a ceremony, nothing is spontaneous. The stuff is planned in advance. The Pope said, I want them to read chapter 15 of Genesis. Why? Because in chapter 15 of Genesis, it says God promised this land to Abraham and his children. So he said, the Vatican hasn't recognized Israel yet, but the Pope says, I want to read this chapter because it's already my spiritual acceptance of the fact that the children of Abraham, the Israelites, are the people of this land. And that was as clear a statement as possible. That's why he chose it. And of course, later on, the Vatican had to recognize Israel because a couple of Arab states had already done it. But it's a very interesting chapter, and it has this mystery about it, about the vision of Abraham and God's vision.
Finally, the law. The Talmud is a 16-volume legal code. Up until recently, Jewish communities the world over were governed by Jewish law as interpreted in the Talmud. This next segment deals with the history of this complex legal system that endures to this day.
The Jews are a nation governed by Jewish law, and therefore they have one legal system which governs the Jewish people. And they are bound together by a cultural unity. So while the Jews are speaking Persian and Aramaic and Babylonian and Arabic and whatever other language they are speaking, they always have Hebrew as part of their cultural heritage, which they are able to read and to write and to speak also. And that is another fascinating feature of Jewish history in general, that from the beginning to the present day, Hebrew has always been a living language. This nonsense that the Hebrew was dead and was revived in the 19th century is not true. It was always a living language. What Eliezer ben Yehuda did in the 20th century, when he wanted to make Hebrew the spoken language of Israel, is to revive it as a spoken modern language in the 20th century. Because when you read documents written in the medieval period, it is a living language. It's not devoted just to rabbinical decrees and to religious laws. What they had in Babylon was a Jewish community with lawyers and judges who judged according to Jewish law. The rabbis are not what we consider clergymen. The rabbis were lawyers and judges. Their function was to govern the Jewish community. And they were rabbis by virtue of their knowledge of the law. I mean, you read the whole, in all the Talmud, students came and they studied law in the centers where there were Jewish schools of law. They attended the courts, they followed lawyers around, they observed them, they learned law by hands-on practice. And at a certain point, they may have been invited to try a case. And if they were found to be competent, they would be invited to try other cases. And then they might be given the recognition of the title of Rav. And then at a certain point, the community might say, you know, this guy should be a judge. So it was a growth in the knowledge of the law, which ultimately led to the building of a body of legal scholars who governed the Jewish community. And by the way, the Jewish government, self-government, was a government that was essentially a jurisprudence government, a judicial government. They governed themselves by virtue of the law as they interpreted it under given conditions and changing conditions. And what is interesting is to see how Jewish law incorporates elements of Babylonian law because they're living in Babylon. Jewish law in Jerusalem is different. That's why the two Talmuds that emerge, the Babylonian Talmud and the Palestinian Talmud, are different in many ways because they're different with dealing with different geographical conditions.
Thank you for listening to Context, the podcast. You can follow the Context blog on the Times of Israel website And please visit drdavidnyman.com for more audio, video, and other fascinating information.